Hello, this is Janet Gowan welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Love letters, as you know, are a gift. They are every love letter you write is a gift custom designed by you for someone. It will never be duplicated, will never go out of style, and will probably be kept forever in some treasure box and be even better if possible generations later. And today's guest has a lot to say about that kind of optimism, looking down the line to something. His name is David Mezapel, and he has written a book called Contagious Optimism, and it's out at bookstores now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Stores and online.
So let's just talk about you, because it's such an interesting thing to make your profession, optimism.
Yes.
Talk about how that came about, what you did before, and...
Sure.
My question is that a genetic gift that you got? Because I believe there is such a thing.
It's quite possible. Mm-hmm. My parents are definitely uplifting type people, very optimistic. They always see the bright side.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, growing up the youngest, mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time with older relatives and older family friends. And I was always amazed by their stories. I never let that go. And when I look back, I realized that all their stories had three things in common. They all started out with some type of adversity.
Oh, the stories about themselves.
Well, it's just growing up with
uh-huh.
stories made me realize I like stories.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And that's really what happened. And looking back, I realized their stories had, you know, these three things.
Mm-hmm.
They had adversity, an element of perseverance, and then wisdom,
mm-hmm.
which they ultimately gained and shared.
Mm-hmm.
So when my alma mater, Fairfield University in Connecticut, had been asking me for years to write a book on optimism and
now,
business.
So why were you asked to do that? I mean, what was your connection even then that you would be asked
sure.
to write a book about it?
Sure. I ran a company called mm-hmm. Goliath Technology for 17 years. We were a data center company. We managed hardware, software, network equipment for all kinds of companies. And I started the company. I had no money.
Mm-hmm.
So I recruited interns all over the world. I was an intern at IBM when I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, hey, I'll hire interns. And I ran the company on a very positive footing. I ran it on positive reinforcement, wisdom that people would gain from their mistakes. Everything I did was positive based. And we grew and grew and grew.
But you know, you're emitting that because I have to think that even if you could get... If you could hire interns, which means getting people to work for you for almost nothing,
right?
In terms of money,
they get experience.
Yes, mm-hmm. but you had to be giving off something
right.
that made it so appealing for them to. Okay,
right. So, well, essentially, but to go back to your question, mm-hmm. what happened was I ran a company on a real positive footing,
mm-hmm.
and we did very well. And then when I sold it, Fairfield had been asking me to write a book on mm-hmm. optimism in business. And by 2010, I was finally ready to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, but let's not just make it about me. Let's make it about lots of people. And not just business, but many of life's themes, including business.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's take it a step further in terms of education. Let's recruit students all over the world so they can get experience working on a published book series. So I'll continue that internship theme even in this project. But yes, I've always been very positive. I don't really know where it came from. I started out that way.
That's what I'm asking.
I loved falling
yes.
off bikes yeah. because I knew I'd get back on.
Uh-huh.
I loved screwing up in sports because I knew I would play better the next time. And I just always found a positive twist on everything negative that ever happened to me. And I think it was because I was exposed to so many stories from older generations growing up. And how they found the bright side. I mean, they came over on ships, you know, Ellis Island.
Yes.
They persevered, worked for nothing for their
right.
families.
Well, that's what I was asking you. So you knew an immigrant generation in your own family?
I knew.
Or of them?
I knew of them,
mm-hmm.
but not just them alone. Just spending time
sure.
with older relatives and older family friends, I was exposed to so many stories.
You know, you see that. And of course, you know, as I said to you before we started here, everything you say in me just triggers off 47 thoughts.
Yes.
And I'm thinking that even the immigrant experience leaving a country for something else when you don't know what it is or if you'll even make it across the ocean.
Yeah, and with very little money, if any.
Little or none. And maybe, you know, a small suitcase of
right.
your whatever you're allowed to leave with or have. Leaving And you see that today. You see that, I mean, in California and Texas and wherever we're near, you know, Central America, people coming to with nothing, excuse me, not knowing what they're going to find.
Right, exactly.
And doing it so that their children will have better. It's all just an act of optimism, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It is. Yes, it is.
Nothing more.
And as a matter of fact, as we get into this show, I already know my answer to who I would send a letter to because of what we just said.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to.
Okay.
You know,
you're going to let me ask that later.
But it's all. See, to me, wisdom, and wisdom is gained from both our ups and our downs.
Oh, yes.
Our mistakes, our successes, our failures, they all generate wisdom. And when you share wisdom, I believe when you share wisdom with others, you're giving them hope. And hope is a huge foundation of optimism. It's a huge foundation. So I always like to say when I give my talks that we all have the capacity to make optimism contagious just by sharing our life's adventures, our successes, and even our mistakes.
Well, you know, when you look at, again, I'm doing it, but when you look at the issue of hope, it's what keeps cultures alive if they stay alive and doing well. It's what keeps people alive. I don't know if you're – and when you see when people lose hope, oh, what can you do?
That's exactly right. It's like turning a switch, and it's very – people are all resilient. They really are. 99.999% of people are resilient, and that's why we see people persevering. And, you know, whether or not people disagree with war, for example, right – you know, I respect people that are pro and against war, but there are people that are actually out there battling, and they have hope that they're going to, you know, keep freedom in this country and give freedom to others.
And come home alive.
And come home alive. Yeah. And when you talk about, like, people that came across to Ellis Island, for example, they came in, they went to New York with no money, they started washing dishes to get a few dollars, but it was all these selfless acts to give more to their family, to get out of country.
That's right, exactly.
And it's amazing. And in your stories, our stories, whether they cover health, whether they cover business, whether they cover relationships, sports, whatever it is, there's always an element of perseverance. And wisdom is gained all along the way.
Yes.
And when you've gotten to that pinnacle point, what's better than sharing that with wisdom with others, whether it's through letters like you do or through books like we do? It's wonderful, and we can't stress enough how important it is. That's what we're about.
That is what we're about. And, you know, the similarity between writing love letters, that's an act of optimism.
Yes.
Because as you're doing it, you're first of all bathing in the positive.
Correct.
Which, no matter who you're writing to, for the time you allow yourself to do it, you are just bathing in the positive for the sake, of a love letter. I had a woman in one of my workshops. And of course, I think with me, and I can see with you, everything is a lesson. And, you know, I do small workshops so we can really talk and then get down to the writing. And she said, well, can I write a hate letter? And the expression on her face went right with that. And I started to laugh. I said, you can, of course, but that's not what this workshop is about.
Exactly.
Let's talk. And when it came to the writing, it turned out that she wasn't filled with hate. She was filled with love, so disappointed that it felt like hate. And when she sat down to express what she really thought and really felt was the disappointment that this friend had turned her back on her, wrote the most beautiful love letter ending with, "The door is always open when you want to come back into my..." I was just...
That's very touching. And it's interesting you mentioned that. I was just talking...
It's a matter of seeing it right.
Exactly. Exactly. You know... hate, and I don't want to go down hate road.
Go any road you want. It's your time here.
You just gave a perfect example of why hate is a form of love. I think if you really don't, if you're not fond of somebody for whatever reason, or you just don't want anything to do with them, I think it's complete indifference.
It's
really what they really are looking for. But when you hate somebody with such passion, I think deep down you actually...
We're hoping for more. And it's expectations.
Right.
Not met. And sometimes, you know, and that's a whole other thing, expectations.
Yes.
That you see a lot of people make excuses for children and instead of expecting. I think high expectations is such a compliment.
Absolutely. Because they're saying that you have the capability. Means you,
yes.
You know, they think they have confidence in you. And what I love about what you do and I really was checking it out the last few days before I came here, is that you talk about love letters, but you don't just mean love letters like most people think about.
Oh, thank you.
You think about, like, your love letters encompass gratitude to a family member, and of course, love or fondness to a significant other or a spouse, forgiveness. You talk about forgiveness.
Yes, and you have to be careful with those. I don't know how, I'd like to know what you feel about this, because you have to say, I forgive you, without being so righteous that somebody's going to want to smack you.
Oh, correct.
You have to, I think you have to forgive without ever saying, I forgive you.
And you could definitely do that.
Oh, yes. And how would you do it in the optimism world you're looking at?
Honesty. I would pour out honesty. If I was to advise someone on how to gain forgiveness, say...
Oh, no, I'm saying giving forgiveness. You're the forgiver.
You're the forgiver. I'm forgiving somebody for something they did.
Yes, and you don't want to say, I forgive you, because that puts you in a kind of a position I'm the judge.
Well, it's funny. In business, for example, whether it's this book or what I did prior, I have a 3 strikes, you're out policy. And very, very rarely... will somebody get to 3 strikes? You know, first mistake is a mistake. Second mistake is almost a circumstance. And the third one, well, you're just not cutting it. But when they get to that second...
So you want consciousness in your peer.
Yes, I want them, because I want them to learn and grow. Especially if they're an intern, it's only for their benefit, right?
Yeah.
Because if they're good, we hire them when they're done.
So how does this get to forgiveness then?
It gets to forgiveness because when somebody screws up really bad in any way, whether it's to me personally or professionally... instead of saying, I forgive you, I spend more time explaining to them how to do things right and what they did wrong and leave it at that. Because that in itself is a form of positive reinforcement.
Oh, yeah. That's huge.
And I think that's the best way.
So in other words, I mean, I think I do the same. Instead of I forgive you, it's I understand why you did what you did.
Right. And here's the right way.
In some form.
And here's the right way.
Yeah.
Or if it's a girlfriend or a spouse and something they did I don't like... it's just honesty.
Oh, yes. And also in the field of, in the world of optimism, I have written to a couple of politicians, by the way.
Nice.
Appreciative letters of something they've done. And in both cases, they weren't huge. It wasn't world peace, because that's going to be a little harder.
Yes.
They were small things. And I got such a response back. I got handwritten letters back.
Yes.
From both. And it occurred to me that for all the people who want to... When you're irritated with something a politician does, and you always hear, I'm going to write her a letter. Well, first of all, people rarely do. But the letters you write ripping someone get probably not read, and they get tossed in the wastebasket.
Completely pointless.
It is completely pointless, isn't it? The letters you write to say, I love that you did this, they get read and reread and reread and carried around in breast pockets.
Yes.
And it makes people want to live up to it and do more right, would you say?
This, when I first heard about what you did, this topic is really what I was excited to talk to you about. No question, what you just said is right on the money. If you come in with a little class, even if it's something you disagree with wholeheartedly, like a politician, for example, if you come in a classy way and say, you know, here's what I do like, just let you know, these are my thoughts on this I don't like, but let's, you know, I'm here to talk if you ever want, da, 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 da. And it's so powerful. And what I want to talk to you about specifically was, for the past 22 years, and I'm being honest, from the very beginning, from the day I graduated college to this present day, whenever I want something, whether it's somebody to write the forward in a book, whether it's a new client I want, an approval by a vendor we desperately needed, or anything in between, I always physically wrote a letter.
Oh, good.
And I will tell you, 99% of the time, I got the result I wanted. And 100% of the time, I got a response. Perfect example. You know Michael Beckwith, Agape Spiritual Center. I'm speaking there on Saturday and Sunday. I wanted Michael to write an endorsement for the book. And I know everybody wants Michael Beckwith. Wrote a letter, no problem. He said, I'll do it. I couldn't believe it. And within a few weeks of writing the letter.
Now, there's a side point to all this.
Yes.
That it has to be done really with sincerity.
No question.
You can't do it to manipulate.
Correct.
Okay. I just want that on.
Correct.
Because there was an article not too long ago on a real estate person. And a young couple who was looking for a house, had written a letter to the owner of the house saying how much they love that house and how they hoped they would get it. And it was a really heartfelt letter. And it helped.
Absolutely. I'm talking strict sincerity.
That's right. And so then there was an article in the newspaper that just made me want to hurl. It was advising people to write letters in the most manipulative...
Ugh, that's terrible.
Yeah, ugh.
Terrible advice. Uh-huh. Terrible. Yeah, see, for example, of all the people that have been part of a lot of the theoretical and spiritual side of optimism, I respect Michael Beckwith. I do. So I wanted him in the book. Mm-hmm. I respect Daniel Tully, who's in the book. He's one of the best CEOs ever seen on Wall Street because he's a real, genuine, principled.
Oh, that's so wonderful that you have your eye on that.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Because there is a side of finance that is an actual side with values and principles.
Of course.
He's all about that. Wrote him a letter. He's in the book. Beckwith's in the book. I wanted Marshall Goldsmith, who is another motivational person, really well respected around the world. I wanted him. Was pretty sure I wasn't going to get him as a forward writer. Wrote a letter, he responded.
Okay, now I have a question. Why do you think that is more effective?
Why?
Yes, because in
this day and age,
yeah,
emails and text messages, it's just a mountain of emptiness. There's nothing there.
But why? I mean...
Why? Because...
What do you think? I mean, I have some thoughts about that. Or one, really.
Well, I'll give you one example. Mm-hmm. Brenda Knight from Viva, right?
Mm-hmm.
Her average day is between 300 and 600 emails. She just can't get to all of them.
No.
But I guarantee she gets to every letter. Mm-hmm. And there's probably just one or two.
Because there is something about a handwritten envelope.
It's because you put the effort in.
Yes, but you put the effort in, and that's evident that you're really a letter you really put yourself into. But I think there's something else. When somebody opens your letter, when Beckwith or Brenda Knight or any of these people, they open your letters, they're touching something that has felt the touch of your hand.
Yes.
And I think that's a little unspoken and, you know, maybe more so between men. I don't know, some wonderful love letters from men to men.
No, I agree.
And so somebody's touching something that you've touched and it's as close to you can get. It's as close as you can get to holding hands or shaking hands over time and distance.
Yes.
I think there's a physical trust in it.
Well, think about the romanticism, and I mean this loosely, but think about the romanticism of the old couriers that delivered mail.
Oh, I do think about that a lot.
Back when this country was first discovered and other countries that have existed. Think about those guys on Pony Express. It's awesome.
I do. I wrote 3 articles about it, and I was just about in tears. Have you ever read the list of their mission?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. To be the bond between scattered families.
Yeah,
that was number 4. That just got me into. I'm going to send you that. I want everybody to read this article. Yes,
these were
brave and selfless men, and it was so dangerous
that
they looked for men who were young and wiry and had no families,
right?
So that when they died on the road
to
some of these outposts, that fewer people would be hurt by it. Oh.
You should really consider sharing a story along those lines for our next volume.
I'd love to.
Because we'd love to have that. Because it's all about perseverance.
Yes.
And you know, a modern day version of that are these bicycle couriers we see in San Fran in New York.
Yes.
I mean, these guys put their life on the line to deliver packages.
To connect people. And what is more important in this world than being
exactly right.
really joyfully or peacefully connected to...
You talk about touching things, right? The
yes.
physical, tangible touching a letter mm-hmm. versus this abstract email. It's interesting when you think about the correlation. Same thing applies to ebooks. I was reading an article in the Wall Street Journal that was talking about the ebook phenomenon is certainly good for the world traveler that loves to read, that can't carry all these books.
Right, I agree.
The people on the trains. But it's already been proven that the ebook has hit a plateau.
Oh,
it's never going to take 100% of the market share of the paperback. It's just not going to. It's eaten into it, but it's capped. They think it's about 30-35%.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that a majority of people still prefer to hold the book.
I believe,
I mean, of course, if you're somebody who gets 100 emails a day, it's not realistic to have 100 letters. But when you do get that one letter, it means a heck of a lot.
Right.
I mean, if I have even junk mail.
I was going to say, because a lot of what you get in email, you'd have to equate to junk mail.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. And even junk mail. If I have, I try to focus on my traveling with one airline just to keep it nice with the miles and everything else mm-hmm. and the club and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that for me, American works the best because of where I go.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if Americans sent me all these promotions that they had through email, I just wouldn't get them. I just wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
But every so often, they send me something really cool in the mail. And I read it, and I get psyched about it, whatever it may be. So even if you're in marketing and promotion, you know, sending something out might cost you more, but I think you're going to get a better response.
Well, you know, Teresa Ayers, with whom I started Love Letters Live, and still miss her in this capacity, although we're close friends and we see each other a lot, she had an impulse to write, and her career was training manuals for corporations. She would take the best and the most effective things that the CEO did, and she would put it into a training manual. So when that CEO left, for some reason, the material wasn't lost.
This is a physical.
Yes. And she would do the training. Anyway, she was, you know, still in the business world, and she brought down a mug that a client from many, many years ago had given her. And like good gifts, they make us think of the giver. And so she was poured her coffee into this mug, and she had such an urge to write to this woman and say, you know, I still use this mug and I think about you. And it was just a simple love letter of memory and appreciation.
Wow.
And the woman called her 2 days later and said, you know, I have a huge project here and your letter reminded me that you're the one who does this. And she got, you know, those kind of things, human communication, because we want to deal with human beings.
Yes, absolutely. I'm really happy to be here because usually for me, I do the same thing over and over. I go, I give a talk, I talk about who I am, why I did the book, and I love doing it.
Yes.
I love it more than anything. But this is such a nice twist because this goes beyond just a book full of stories.
Well, you know, it is a book full of stories.
It is.
I mean, I've been doing this for 9 years, and I will say every love letter, it's a book full of stories, but they're kind of separated chapters.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, if you think about... Think about a couple. Let's think about a couple, and they're in a bad situation right now. Whatever reason, they're on the rocks. And imagine one of them receives a letter from the other. Well, I don't have to tell you to imagine. You probably see it all the time. But one of them receives a letter from the other where they really put out on paper, spent the time and wrote out this whole thing. And really, whether it's an apology looking for forgiveness.
Oh, I was going to say that before, that apologies is... An apology is one of the most elegant forms of love letter.
I imagine so. And if the person did that same thing, just sitting on their iPhone, typing an email, it doesn't have the same, I don't want to say validity.
It somehow doesn't count the same.
It doesn't. And if I was the other party, I would stop and say, wow, he or she really feels bad. And I would take it to heart. And then before you know it, that feeling becomes hope. That hope becomes optimism. Then I pick up the phone and say, hey, why don't we get together and talk about this?
Right.
So look at the snowball effect in a good way of what that letter has done.
And there's an emotional presence, though, I'm going to say, I wish this were a television moment, because your very hand language and what you're doing is there's an emotional presence to writing a letter that, you know, the way you were kind of miming the email.
Yes.
You know, and your fingers were going, but your eyes were not there.
Right.
And I think there is something to that.
No question.
There's an emotional presence about writing a letter. And in something like an apology or a love letter, there's also the optimism, hope of something better.
Yes.
I mean, isn't that what an apology is? You hope for a better connection, and you've signed it. In your own handwriting, does that not have the force of a legal contract in some way?
There's no question. And you know, we often talk about, along those lines, we talk about you can't change the past. So all you could do is look at the past as an educational tool, no different than when you first learn to ride a bike. So let's just go back to the relationship thing. If you screwed up in a relationship, well, you can't go back and change it. So what do I need to do to make this right? Well, whatever it is, it's going to be in the future because you can't change the past.
Yeah.
So why not write a beautiful letter explaining what you did, why you did it, why you're sorry for it, or whatever you want to word it. Because at least you're acknowledging what happened, but you're being realistic that you can't change it. I can't change what I did.
I can't change what I did, but I can change how I'm going to do it from now on.
Exactly.
My mother used to say on occasion, when there would be a, you know, I'd make a really blunderous mistake. As a, you know, as a teenager, as a kid, I'd do something, and she'd say, oh, she said, so you made a mistake. She'd say, just consider it another semester at Harvard.
There you go. That's terrific.
I think that was always so good.
Yes, there's no question. I mean, for me, professionally, in 2000, when we were 10 years in business, from 1996 to 2000, one of the industries we supported was tech, actually right here. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time back then working out here. And we had too many eggs in one basket. We were supporting all these tech companies. So in 2000, really March, when that bubble burst and all the tech stocks got hurt and all those companies got hurt, we got hurt. Mm-hmm. It was devastating. And instead of just wallowing in this and dealing and just closing our doors, I said, look, we're going to go after other emerging markets. We've learned not to keep all our eggs in one basket. And we have enough left to survive. And we turned ourselves around better than we were before. I wasn't just optimistic, but I was also realistic that I learned mm-hmm. that I can never, ever let us focus on one industry again. We have like 85% of our revenue is from tech. It's mm-hmm. very dangerous. And that's even professionally, that's when I started realizing there is so much wisdom gained from all these footsteps we've made.
Well, in that light, let me ask you, because you had alluded to it before, who would get your love letter today? And I hope will get.
Right. Well, I don't know if this is the answer you want, but
have an answer because I had one guest who wrote a love letter to her horse, the only creature who ever listened to her. I'm open to anything.
Okay, well,
it's your letter.
So when you first said to me, you know, who would get your letter, I thought immediately something came to mind. Then I said, nah, it's not going to work. And then I thought all these other things. I said, nope, you go with your first thought. And my first thought was I'd write one letter mm-hmm. and I'd blanket copy everybody alive or dead in the silent generation and the greatest generation. And the reason is because those two generations, more than any other really in our history, were the most selfless.
Now, when you say that, you define those two, if you would, the two generations.
Sure. The greatest generation was born 1900 to 1924.
I see. Okay.
And the silent generation was 1925 to 1942.
Uh-huh.
So you're talking about the industrialists, the immigrants, you're talking about the Depression, the war, mm-hmm. but all that.
Okay.
And all these people, and I deal with a lot of them because we go into senior living communities also to get
yes.
the story.
And some are still here, you're saying.
Yeah, yes. There's a fair amount. These people gave and gave and gave for the purpose of others, mostly their family, their church, their synagogue, whatever it may be. They gave for others. Mm-hmm. Today, so much is a me generation. I think more and more people are realizing that, and we're seeing some optimism there. But those generations, I'd write a love letter that is a huge thank you for this wonderful world we live in now, beautiful country that we're in here, and yes. all the great things they did for us. You know, what they did, coming across with nothing, like you mentioned uh-huh. before. Taking jobs that were menial jobs to put their kids in school.
I like this a lot. I wouldn't laugh. And I tend to laugh, but even with affection. This is so important, and it points out another kind of love letter that I really treasure, and you will know this. Love letters that carry historical information in them. And you see these. You see these love letters between, you know, from a woman to her young husband or sweetheart who's away at war, and she's describing what life is like at home and how sad she is to be having it without him. But interlaced in this love letter is a history, documentation of history.
Yes.
That is invaluable. That's real history.
Yes.
So
absolutely.
What you're doing would be the same thing, and I know that you're going to be expressing compassionately where it needs to be and optimistically because I can see that's all you.
Right.
What about handwriting and where will you send it? Because handwriting is king, as you pointed out, in what you get. Where will you send it?
That's a great question.
Sometimes that's tricky.
It's a tricky question. What I would do is probably right now all these corporations own mm-hmm. all the assisted living and the independent living. There's probably maybe 10 corporations that own them all now. It's become a huge conglomerate.
Right.
I would say I would send this letter to corporate of all these companies.
Well, that's wonderful.
And say, now, distribute this to your residents.
That's going to be hard to do in your own handwriting.
Well, I would actually do one letter and copy it.
Okay. So handwritten, I hope.
Handwritten and copy.
Okay. And what do you do with the original?
I frame it and put it on my wall.
Okay. That's exactly pretty yeah. much a mail it to yourself before you put it on the wall. Awesome. Put it in an envelope and address it to yourself.
That's so cool.
In your own handwriting, and you're going to see. I mean, I just know this is true. I'd be surprised if it were different. You can call me someday and tell
sure.
me that the you who wrote the letter is not the same you who is going to read the letter.
Yes. I absolutely.
Oh, will you do that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I will do that. And it's funny because several of the stories I tell, half the stories I when I give a talk are a variety of ages, young, middle age, older. But then I reserve five or six for seniors of what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, we have a woman named Diane May that I met at a senior facility in mm-hmm. South Florida. When Diane was a little girl, her father would whistle like a mockingbird to mm-hmm. call her home for dinner. And today she's in her mid-90s. And every bird she hears reminds her of her childhood.
Yes.
So she even wrote a children's manuscript, 50,000 words, called The Perfect Whistle, mm-hmm. about a mockingbird named Maxwell that whistled pleasant songs mm-hmm. to soldiers during the war help remind them of home. And despite her age, she wants to get it published. And it's sort of along the lines of what we're talking about, because this childhood memory resonated with her. She was alive through the war.
Yes.
She envisioned this bird singing to these soldiers, and it is so powerful.
See, I think people talk about, you know, doing living histories and oral histories, and they put them on tapes and recording.
Yes.
But I will tell you, the technology changes, and what you record today, you're not going to be able to play in 20 years.
Right.
And what you do, photographs, it doesn't matter. Technology changes too much. Handwriting and letters we have from 400 years ago, and they're still good.
Yes.
And it will last much longer.
Correct. Correct.
And somebody's going to find this on your wall when you're long gone.
That's pretty cool.
Pardon me?
Yeah, they're going to say, wow, this is pretty interesting.
Yes. Some historian's going to get a PhD out of it and think he's discovered gold.
Oh, no question.
And will have.
Well, I'll tell you another really amazing story. I was at another senior community up in, I don't remember if it was New Hampshire or Maine, it was a couple years ago. It was an older gentleman, and he was alive, obviously. His wife had passed away,
mm-hmm.
and he was also in World War II. And he had all the letters he wrote her.
Uh-huh.
So after my talk, and I gave all these examples, he comes out with this stack of letters,
uh-huh.
and we sat down, and I was running so late, but I didn't have the heart to leave. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah.
So he breaks out all these love letters to his wife, who was his girlfriend at the time,
mm-hmm.
or his fiancée,
mm-hmm.
and we're going through them, and exactly what you just said, each one had historical significance.
Yes.
Because he was talking about what was going on in the country he was stationed in, what was going on with other people in his peer group. And it was so interesting. And he had them all. And they were the ones he sent his mm-hmm. wife. Right down to the envelope.
And right down to the envelope,
yeah.
which has the handwriting of an era.
Yes.
And the stamps are part of the gift.
Correct.
Because you chew. Okay, I wish we could just talk forever.
Yep.
Unfortunately. Will you come back?
Yes,
When you're
absolutely.
Here next time and just share more of these stories of
yeah,
love letters?
Yeah, we're always gaining stories. I would definitely keep you posted on this. I'll be back in early 2014.
Okay, so we have another. Let's.
Absolutely.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. I look forward to that. I thank you so much for doing this with me. There
yes.
are so many lessons that you just carry optimism in your wake. It just every footstep is preceded by it. I can see that when you walked in here.
Oh, yeah. As
thank
a matter of fact,
you,
my closing line at every event is we are all naturally mentors just by the sheer impression of our footsteps.
Okay.
That's
wonderful.
My closing line
okay.
at all our events.
And mine, which I'm going to now sign off with, is... Please remember, if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, writing a love letter is that special occasion. So I thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye.